18 years. I opened the trunk, took out the briefcase, and decided to leave everything else. For all I knew, it might end up being sold at the Jolly White Elephant, the second-hand store not far from Titus Chevron. I crossed the street toward the mill's dragon breath, a shat-hoosh, shat-hoosh that would continue around the clock until Reagan-era free trade rendered pricey American textiles obsolete. The drying shed was lit by a white fluorescent glow from the dirty dye-house windows. I spotted the chain blocking off the drying shed from the rest of the courtyard. It was too dark to read the sign hanging from it, and it had been almost 2 months since I'd seen it, but I remembered what it said. No admittance beyond this point until sewer pipe is repaired. There was no sign of the yellow card man, or the orange card man, if that's what he was now. Headlights flooded the courtyard, illuminating me like an ant on a plate. My shadow jumped out, long and scrawny, in front of me. I froze as a big transport truck trundled toward me. I expected the driver to stop, lean out, and ask me what the hell I was doing here. He slowed, but didn't stop. Raised a hand to me. I raised mine in return, and he drove on toward the loading docks with dozens of empty barrels clunking around in back. I headed for the chain, took one quick look around, and ducked under it. I walked down the flank of the drying shed, heart beating hard in my chest. The gash on my head pounded in harmony. This time there was no chunk of concrete to mark the spot. Slow, I told myself. Slow. The step is right here. Only it wasn't. There was nothing but the pavement under my testing, tapping shoe. I went a little farther, and there was still nothing. It was cold enough to see a thin vapor when I exhaled, but a light, greasy sweat had broken out on my arms and neck. I went a little farther, but was now almost sure I'd gone too far. Either the rabbit hole was gone, or it had never been there in the first place, which meant that my whole life as Jake Epping, everything from my prize-winning FFA garden in grammar school to my abandoned novel in college, to my marriage to a basically sweet woman who'd almost drowned my love for her in alcohol, had been a crazy hallucination. I'd been George Amberson all along. I went a little farther, then stopped, breathing hard. Somewhere, maybe in the dye house, maybe in one of the weaving rooms, someone shouted, "Fuck me sideways!" I jumped, then jumped again at the bull roar of laughter that followed the exclamation. Not here. Gone. Or never was. And did I feel disappointment? Terror? Outright panic? None of those, actually. What I felt was a sneaking sense of relief. What I thought was, I could live here, and quite easily, happily even. Was that true? Yes. Yes. It stank near the mills and on public conveyances where everybody smoked their heads off, but in most places the air smelled incredibly sweet, incredibly new. Food tasted good. Milk was delivered directly to your door. After a period of withdrawal from my computer, I'd gained enough perspective to realize just how addicted to that fucking thing I'd become. Spending hours reading stupid email attachments and visiting websites for the same reason mountaineers wanted to climb Everest, because they were there. My cell phone never rang because I had no cell phone. And what a relief that had been. Outside of the big cities, most folks were still on party lines. And did the majority lock their doors at night? Balls they did. They worried about nuclear war, but I was safe in the knowledge that the people of 1958 would grow old and die without ever hearing of an A-bomb being exploded in anything but a test. No one worried about global warming or suicide bombers flying hijacked jets into skyscrapers. And if my 2011 life wasn't a hallucination, in my heart I knew this, I could still stop Oswald. I just wouldn't know the ultimate result. I thought I could live with that. Okay. The first thing to do was to return to the Sunliner and get out of Lisbon Falls. I'd drive to Lewiston, find the bus station, and buy a ticket to New York. I'd take a train to Dallas from there. Or hell, why not fly? I still had plenty of cash, and no airline clerk was going to demand a picture ID. All I had to do was fork over the price of a ticket, and Transworld Airlines would welcome me aboard. The relief of this decision was so great that my legs went rubbery again. The weakness wasn't as bad as it had been in Derry when I'd had to sit down, but I leaned against the drying shed for support. My elbow struck it, making a soft bong sound. And a voice spoke to me out of thin air. Hoarse. Almost a growl. A voice from the future, as it were.
Jake? Is that you?
This was followed by a fusillade of dry, barking coughs. I almost kept silent. I could have kept silent. Then I thought of how much of his life Al had invested in this project and how I was now the only thing he had left to hope for. I turned toward the sound of those coughs and spoke in a low voice. Al? Talk to me. Count off. I could have added, or just keep coughing. He began to count. I went toward the sound of the numbers, feeling with my foot. After 10 steps, far beyond the place where I had given up, the toe of my shoe simultaneously took a step forward and struck something that stopped it cold. I took one more look around, took one more breath of the chemical stenchy air. Then I closed my eyes and started climbing steps I couldn't see. On the fourth one, the chilly night air was replaced with stuffy warmth and the smells of coffee and spices. At least that was the case with my top half. Below the waist, I could still feel the night. I stood there for maybe 3 seconds, half in the present and half in the past. Then I opened my eyes, saw Al's haggard, anxious, too thin face, and stepped back into 2011. Part 3. Living in the Past. Chapter 9. I would have said I was beyond surprise by then, but what I saw just to Al's left dropped my jaw. A cigarette smoldering in an ashtray. I reached past him and stubbed it out. "Do you want to cough up whatever working lung tissue you've got left?" He didn't respond to that. I'm not sure he even heard it. He was staring at me, wide-eyed.
"Jesus God, Jake! Who scalped you?"
"No one. Let's get out of here before I strangle on your second-hand smoke." But that was empty scolding. During the weeks I'd spent in Derry, I'd gotten used to the smell of burning cigarettes. Soon I'd be picking up the habit myself if I didn't watch out.
"You are scalped," he said. "You just don't know it. There's a piece of your hair hanging down behind your ear. And how much did you bleed anyway, a quart? And who did it to you?"
A, less than a quart. B, Frank Dunning. If that takes care of your questions, now I've got one. You said you were going to pray. Why were you smoking instead?
"Because I was nervous. And because it doesn't matter now.
The horse is out of the barn."
I could hardly argue on that score. Al made his way slowly behind the counter, where he opened a cabinet and took out a plastic box with a red cross on it. I sat on one of the stools and looked at the clock. It had been 7:45 when Al unlocked the door and led us into the diner. Probably 5 of when I went down the rabbit hole and emerged in Wonderland circa 1958. Al claimed every trip took exactly 2 minutes, and the clock on the wall seemed to bear that out. I'd spent 52 days in 1958, but here it was 7:59 in the morning. Al was assembling gauze, tape, disinfectant.
"Bend down here so I can see it," he said. "Put your chin right on the counter."
"You can skip the hydrogen peroxide. It happened 4 hours ago, and it's clotted, see?"
"Better safe than sorry," he said, then set the top of my head on fire. "Ow! Hurts, don't it?"
"Because it's still open. You want some 1958 Sawbones treating you for an infected scalp before you head down to Big D? Believe me, buddy, you don't.
Hold still.
I have to snip some hair, or the tape won't hold. Thank God you kept it short." Clip, clip, clip. Then he added to the pain, insult to injury, as they say, by pressing gauze to the laceration and taping it down. "You can take the gauze off in a day or two, but you'll want to keep your hat over it until then. Gonna look a little mangy up top there for a while. But if the hair doesn't grow back, you can always comb it over. Want some aspirin?"
"Yes."
"And a cup of coffee? Can you rustle that?" Although coffee would only help for a little while, what I needed was sleep.
"I can."
He flicked the switch on the bun-o-matic, then began rummaging in the first aid kit again. "You look like you've lost some weight."
"You should talk," I thought.
"I've been sick. Caught a 24-hour. That was where I stopped.
"Jake, what's wrong?"
I was looking at Al's framed photographs. When I'd gone down the rabbit hole, there had been a picture of Harry Dunning and me up there. We were smiling and holding up Harry's GED diploma for the camera. It was gone.
"Jake? Buddy? What is it?"
I took the aspirin he'd put on the counter, stuck them in my mouth, dry swallowed. Then I got up and walked slowly over to the wall of celebrity. I felt like a man made of glass. Where the picture of Harry and me had hung for the last 2 years, there was now one of Al shaking hands with Mike Michaud, the U.S. representative from Maine's 2nd District. Michaud must have been running for re-election because Al was wearing 2 buttons on his cook's apron. One said Michaud for Congress, the other said Lisbon loves Mike. The honorable representative was wearing a bright orange Moxie t-shirt and holding up a dripping fat burger for the camera. I lifted the photo from its hook. "How long has this been here?" He looked at it, frowning.
"I've never seen that picture in my life. God knows I supported Michaud in his last 2 runs. Hell, I support any Democrat who ain't been caught screwing his campaign aides. And I met him at a rally in 008. But that was in Castle Rock. He's never been in the diner."
"Apparently he has been. That's your counter, isn't it?" He took the picture in hands now so scrawny they were little more than talons and held it close to his face.
"Hell," he said. "It sure is."
"So there is a butterfly effect. This photo's proof." He looked at it fixedly, smiling a little. In wonder, I think. Or maybe awe. Then he handed it back to me and went behind the counter to pour the coffee. "Al, you still remember Harry, don't you? Harry Dunning?"
"Of course I do. Isn't he why you went to Derry and almost got your head knocked off?"
"For him and the rest of his family, yes."
"And did you save them?"
"All but one. His father got Tugga before we could stop him."
"Who's we?"
"I'll tell you everything, but first I'm going home to bed."
"Buddy, we don't have a lot of time."
"I know that," I said, thinking all I have to do is look at you, Al. "But I'm dead for sleep. For me it's 1:30 in the morning, and I've had... My mouth opened in a huge yawn.
I've had quite a night.
All right. He brought coffee, a full cup for me, black, half a cup for him, liberally dosed with cream.
Tell me what you can while you drink this.
First, explain to me how you can remember Harry if he was never a janitor at LHS and never bought a fatburger from you in his whole life. Second, explain to me why you don't remember Mike Michaud visiting the diner when that picture says he did.
You don't know for a fact that Harry Dunning's not still in town, Al said. In fact, you don't know for sure he's not still janitoring at Lisbon High.
It'd be a hell of a coincidence if he was. I changed the past big time, Al, with some help from a guy named Bill Turkett. Harry wouldn't have gone to live with his aunt and uncle in Haven because his mother didn't die. Neither did his brother Troy or his sister Ellen. And Dunning never got near Harry himself with that hammer of his. If Harry still lives in the Falls after all those changes, I'd be the most surprised guy on earth.
There's a way to check, Al said. I've got a laptop computer in my office. Come on back.
He led the way, coughing and holding on to things. I carried my cup of coffee with me. He left his behind. Office was far too grand a name for the closet-sized cubbyhole off the kitchen. It was hardly big enough for both of us. The walls were papered with memos, permits, and health directives from both the state of Maine and the feds. If the people who passed on rumors and gossip about the famous cat burger had seen all that paperwork, which included a Class A certification of cleanliness following the last inspection by the State of Maine Restaurant Commission, they might have been forced to rethink their position. Harry's MacBook sat on the sort of desk I remember using in the third grade. He collapsed into a chair of about the same size with a grunt of pain and relief.
High school's got a website, doesn't it?
Sure. While we waited for the laptop to boot, I wondered how many emails had piled up during my 52-day absence. Then I remembered I'd actually been gone only 2 minutes. Silly me.
I think I'm losing it, Al, I said. I know the feeling. Just hang on, buddy. Wait, here we go. Let's see. Courses, summer schedule, faculty, administration, custodial staff.
Hit it, I said. He massaged the touchpad, muttered, nodded, clicked on something, then stared into the computer screen like a swami consulting his crystal ball. Well, don't keep me hanging. He turned the laptop so I could look. LHS custodial staff, it said, the best in Maine. There was a photograph of two men and a woman standing at center court in the gymnasium. They were all smiling. They were all wearing Lisbon Greyhound sweatshirts. None of them was Harry Dunning.
You remember him in his life as a janitor, and as your student because you're the one who went down the rabbit hole, Al said.
We were back in the diner again, sitting in one of the booths.
I remember him, either because I've used the rabbit hole myself or just because I'm near it.
He considered.
That's probably it. A kind of radiation. The yellow card man's also near it, only on the other side, and he feels it too. You've seen him, so you know.
He's the orange card man now.
What are you talking about?
I yawned again. If I tried to tell you now, I'd make a total mess of everything. I want to drive you home, then go home myself. I'm going to get something to eat because I'm hungry as a bear.
I'll scramble you up some eggs, he said.
He started to rise, then sat back down with a thump and began to cough. Each inhale was a hacking wheeze that shook his whole body. Something rattled in his throat like a playing card in the spokes of a bicycle wheel. I put my hand on his arm. What you'll do is go back home, take some dope, and rest. Sleep, if you can. I know I can. 8 hours. I'll set the alarm. He stopped coughing, but I could still hear that playing card rattling in his throat.
Sleep. The good kind. I remember that. I envy you, buddy.
I'll be back at your place by 7 tonight. No, let's say 8. That'll give me a chance to check a few things on the internet.
And if everything looks... Jake?
He smiled faintly at this pun, which I, of course, had heard at least 1,000 times. Then I'll go back again tomorrow and get ready to do the deed.
No, he said. You're going to undo the deed.
He squeezed my hand. His fingers were thin, but there was still strength in his grip.
That's what this is all about. Finding Oswald. Undoing his fuckery. And wiping that self-satisfied smirk off his face.
When I started my car, the first thing I did was reach for the stubby Ford gear shift on the column and punch for the springy Ford clutch with my left foot. When my fingers closed around nothing but air and my shoe thumped on nothing but floor mat, I laughed. I couldn't help it.
What?
Al asked from his place in the shotgun seat. I missed my nifty Ford Sunliner. That was what. But it was okay. Soon, I'd buy it again. Although since next time I'd be shorter of funds, at least to start with, my deposit at the hometown trust would be gone. Lost in the next reset. I might dicka a little more with Bill Titus. I thought I could do that. I was different now.
Jake! Something funny?
It's nothing. I looked for changes on Main Street, but all the usual buildings were present and accounted for, including the Kennebec Fruit, which looked, as usual, about 2 unpaid bills away from financial collapse. The statue of Chief Warumbo still stood in the town park, and the banner in the window of Cable's Furniture still assured the world that we will not be undersold. Al, you remember the chain you have to duck under to get back to the rabbit hole, don't you?
Sure.
And the sign hanging from it?
The one about the sewer pipe.
He was sitting like a soldier who thinks the road ahead may be mined, and every time we went over a bump, he winced. When you came back from Dallas, when you realized you were too sick to make it, was that sign still there?
Yeah,
he had said after a moment's reflection.
It was. That's kind of funny, isn't it?
Who takes 4 years to fix a busted sewer pipe?
Nobody.
Not in a mill yard where trucks are coming and going all day and all night. So why doesn't it attract attention? He shook his head.
No idea.
It might be there to keep people from wandering into the rabbit hole by accident. But if so, who put it there?
I don't know. I don't even know if what you're saying is right.
I turned onto his street, hoping I could see him safely inside and then manage the 7 or 8 miles out to Sabattis without falling asleep behind the wheel. But one other thing was on my mind, and I needed to say it, if only so I wouldn't get his hopes up too high. The past is obdurate, Al. It doesn't want to be changed.
I know. I told you.
You did, but what I think now is that the resistance to change is proportional to how much the future might be altered by any given act. He looked at me. The patches beneath his eyes were darker than ever, and the eyes themselves shone with pain.
Could you give it to me in English?
Changing the Dunning family's future was harder than changing Carolyn Poulin's future. Partly because there were more people involved, but mostly because the Poulin girl would have lived either way. Doris Dunning and her kids all would have died. And one of them died anyway, although I intend to remedy that. A ghost of a smile touched his lips.
Good for you.
Just make sure that next time you duck a little more. Save yourself from having to deal with an embarrassing scar where the hair may not grow back. I had ideas about that, but didn't bother saying so. I nosed my car up his driveway. What I'm saying is that I may not be able to stop Oswald. At least not the first time. I laughed. But what the hell? I flunked my driver's test the first time, too.
So did I, but they didn't make me wait 5 years to take it again.
He had a point there.
What are you, Jake, 30? 32?
35. And 2 months closer to 36 than I had been earlier this morning, but what was a couple of months between friends?
If you screwed the pooch and had to start over, you'd be 45, when the merry-go-round came back to the brass ring the second time. A lot can happen in 10 years, especially if the past's against you.
I know, I said. Look what happened to you.
I got lung cancer from smoking, that's all.
He coughed as if to prove this. But I saw doubt as well as pain in his eyes. Probably that's all it was. I hope that's all it was, but it's one more thing we don't know. His front door banged open. A large young woman wearing a lime green smock and white Nancy nurse shoes came half running down the driveway. She saw Al slumped in the passenger seat of my Toyota and yanked open the door.
Mr. Templeton, where have you been? I came in to give you your meds, and when I found the house empty, I thought...
He managed a smile.
I know what you thought, but I'm okay. Not beautiful, but okay.
She looked at me.
And you? What are you doing driving him around? Can't you see how fragile he is?
Of course I could, but since I could hardly tell her what we'd been doing, I kept my mouth shut and prepared to take my scolding like a man.
We had an important matter to discuss, Al said. Okay? Got it? Just the same.
He opened the car door.
Help me inside, Doris. Jake's got to get home.
Doris? As in Dunning. He didn't notice the coincidence, and surely that was what it was. It's a common enough name, but it clanged in my head just the same. I made it home, and this time it was the Sunliner's emergency brake I found myself reaching for. As I turned off the engine, I thought about what a cramped, niggardly, basically unpleasant plastic and fiberglass shitbox my Toyota was compared to the car I'd gotten used to in Derry. I let myself in, started to feed my cat, and saw the food in his dish was still fresh and moist. Why wouldn't it be? In 2011... It had been in the bowl for only an hour and a half. Eat that, Elmore, I said. There are cats starving in China who'd love a bowl of Frisky's Choice Cuts. Elmore gave me the look that one deserved and oiled out through the cat door. I nuked a couple of Stouffer's frozen dinners, thinking like Frankenstein's monster learning to talk.
Microwave good. Modern cars bad.
I ate everything, disposed of the trash, and went into the bedroom. I took off my plain white 1958 shirt, thanking God Al's Doris had been too mad to notice the blood spatters on it, sat on the side of the bed to unlace my sensible 1958 shoes, and then let myself fall backward. I'm pretty sure I fell asleep while I was still in midair. I forgot all about setting the alarm and might have slept long past 5 p.m., but Elmore jumped on my chest at 4:15 and began to sniff at my face. That meant he'd cleaned his dish and was requesting a refill. I provided more food for the feline, splashed my face with cold water, then ate a bowl of Special K, thinking it would be days before I could get the proper order of my meals reestablished. Bellyful, I went into the study and booted up my computer. The town library was my first cyber stop. Al was right. They had the entire run of the Lisbon Weekly Enterprise in their database. I had to become a friend of the library before I could access the goodies, which cost $10, but given the circumstances, That seemed a small price to pay. The issue of the Enterprise I was looking for was dated November 7th. On page 2, sandwiched between an item about a fatal car wreck and one concerning a case of suspected arson, was a story headlined "Local Police Seek Mystery Man." The mystery man was me, or rather my Eisenhower-era alter ego. The Sunliner convertible had been found, the bloodstains duly noted. Bill Titus identified the Ford as one he had sold to a Mr. George Amberson. The tone of the article touched my heart. Simple concern for a missing and possibly injured man's whereabouts. Gregory Dewson, my hometown trust banker, described me as a well-spoken and polite fellow. Eddie Baumer, proprietor of Baumer's Barbershop, said essentially the same thing. Not a single whiff of suspicion accrued to the Amberson name. Things might have been different if I'd been linked to a certain sensational case in Derry, but I hadn't been. Nor was I in the following week's issue, where I had been reduced to a mere squib in the police beat. Search for missing Wisconsin man continues. In the issue following that, the Weekly Enterprise had gone gaga for the upcoming holiday season, and George Amberson disappeared from the paper entirely. But I had been there. Al carved his name on a tree. I'd found mine in the pages of an old newspaper. I'd expected it, but looking at the actual proof was still awe-inspiring. I went next to the Derry Daily News website. It cost me considerably more to access their archives, $34.50. But within a matter of minutes, I was looking at the front page of the issue for the 1st of November, 1958. You would expect a sensational local crime to headline the front page of a local newspaper, but in Derry, the peculiar little city, they kept as quiet as possible about their atrocities. The big story that day had to do with Russia, Great Britain, and the United States meeting in Geneva to discuss a possible nuclear test ban treaty. Below this was a story about a 14-year-old chess prodigy named Bobby Fischer. At the very bottom of the front page, on the left-hand side, where media experts tell us people are apt to look last, if at all, was a story headlined, "Murderous Rampage Ends in 2 Deaths." According to the story, Frank Dunning, a prominent member of the business community and active in many charity drives, had arrived at the home of his estranged wife in a state of inebriation shortly after 8 p.m. on Friday night. After an argument with his wife, which I certainly did not hear, and I was there, Dunning struck her with a hammer, breaking her arm, and then killed his 12-year-old son, Arthur Dunning, when Arthur tried to defend his mother. The story was continued on page 12. When I turned there, I was greeted by a snapshot of my old frenemy, Bill Turkett. According to the story, Mr. Turkett was passing by when he heard shouts and screams from the Dunning residence. He rushed up the walk, saw what was going on through the open door, and told Mr. Frank Dunning to stop laying about with that hammer. Dunning refused. Mr. Turkett spotted a sheathed hunting knife on Dunning's belt and pulled it free. Dunning rounded on Mr. Turkett, who grappled with him. During the ensuing struggle, Dunning was stabbed to death. Only moments later, the heroic Mr. Turkett suffered a heart attack. I sat looking at the old snapshot, Turkett standing with one foot placed proudly on the bumper of a late 40s sedan, cigarette in the corner of his mouth, and drumming my fingers on my thighs. Dunning had been stabbed from the back, not from the front, and with a bayonet, not a hunting knife. Dunning hadn't even had a hunting knife. The sledgehammer, which was not identified as such, had been his only weapon. Could the police have missed such glaring details? I didn't see how, unless they were as blind as Ray Charles. Yet for Derry, as I had come to know it, all this made perfect sense. I think I was smiling. The story was so crazy, it was admirable. All the loose ends were tied up. You had your crazy drunk husband, your cowering, terrified family, and your heroic passerby. No indication what he'd been passing by on his way to. What else did you need? And there was no mention of a certain mysterious stranger at the scene. It was all so dairy. I rummaged in the fridge, found some leftover chocolate pudding, and hoovered it up while standing at the counter and looking out into my backyard. I picked up Elmore and petted him until he wriggled to be put down. I returned to my computer, tapped a key to magic away the screensaver, and looked at the picture of Bill Turkett some more. The heroic intervener who had saved the family and suffered a heart attack for his pains. At last, I went to the telephone and dialed directory assistance. There was no listing for Doris, Troy, or Harold Dunning in Derry. As a last resort, I tried Ellen, not expecting anything. Even if she were still in town, she'd probably taken the name of her husband. But sometimes long shots are lucky shots, Lee Harvey Oswald being a particularly malignant case in point. I was so surprised when the phone robot coughed up a number that I wasn't even holding my pencil. Rather than redial directory assistance, I pushed 1 to call the number I'd requested. Given time to think about it, I'm not sure I would have done that. Sometimes we don't want to know, do we? Sometimes we're afraid to know. We go just so far, then turn back. But I held bravely onto the receiver and listened as a phone in Derry rang once, twice, 3 times. The answering machine would probably kick on after the next one, and I decided I didn't want to leave a message. I had no idea what to say. But halfway through the 4th ring, a woman said, "Hello? Is this Ellen Dunning?" "Well, I guess that depends on who's calling." She sounded cautiously amused. The voice was smoky and a little insinuating. If I didn't know better, I would have imagined a woman in her 30s, rather than one who was now either 60 or pushing it hard. It was the voice, I thought, of someone who used it professionally. A singer, an actress, maybe a comedian or comedienne after all. None of them seemed likely in Derry. "My name is George Amberson. I knew your brother Harry a long time ago. I was back in Maine, and I thought maybe I'd try to get in touch." "Harry?" She sounded startled. "Oh, my God! Was it in the Army?" Had it been? I thought fast and decided that couldn't be my story. Too many potential pitfalls. No, back in Derry, when we were kids." Inspiration struck. "We used to play at the rec. Same teams, palled around a lot." "Well, I'm sorry to tell you this, Mr. Amberson, but Harry's dead." For a moment I was dumbstruck. Only that doesn't work on the phone, does it? I managed to say, "Oh, God, I'm so sorry." "It was a long time ago, in Vietnam, during the Tet Offensive." I sat down, feeling sick to my stomach. I'd saved him from a limp and some mental fogginess only to cut his lifespan by 40 years or so. Terrific. The surgery was a success, but the patient died. Meanwhile, the show had to go on. "What about Troy? And you, how are you? You were just a little kid back then, riding a bike with training wheels. And singing. You were always singing." I essayed a feeble laugh. "Gosh, you used to drive us crazy." "The only singing I do these days is on karaoke night at Bennigan's Pub. But I never did get tired of running my mouth. I'm a jock on WKIT up in Bangor. You know, a disc jockey." "Uh-huh. And Troy?" "Living La Vida Loca in Palm Springs. He's the rich fella in the family. Made a bundle in the computer biz. Got in on the ground floor back in the 70s, goes to lunch with Steve Jobs and stuff." She laughed. It was a terrific laugh. I bet people all over eastern Maine tuned in just to hear it. But when she spoke again, her tone was lower, and all the humor had gone out of it. Sun to shade, just like that. "Who are you, really, Mr. Amberson?" "What do you mean?" "I do call-in shows on the weekends. A yard sale show on Saturdays. I've got a rototiller, Ellen, almost brand new, but I can't make the payments, and I'll take the best offer over $50. Like that. On Sundays, it's politics. Folks call in to flay Rush Limbaugh or talk about how Glenn Beck should run for president. I know voices. If you'd been friends with Harry back in the wreck days, you'd be in your 60s. But you're not. You sound like you're no more than 35. Jesus, right on the money.
People tell me I sound a lot younger than my age. I bet they tell you the same.
Nice try, she said flatly, and all at once she did sound older. I've had years of training to put that sunshine in my voice, have you? I couldn't think of a response, so I kept silent. Also, no one calls to check up on someone they chummed around with when they were in grammar school. Not 50 years later, they don't. Might as well hang up, I thought. I got what I called for and more than I bargained for. I'll just hang up. But the phone felt glued to my ear. I'm not sure I could have dropped it if I'd seen fire racing up my living room curtains. When she spoke again, there was a catch in her voice. "Are you him?" "I don't know what you..." "There was somebody else there that night. Harry saw him, and so did I." "Are you him?" "One night." My lips had gone numb. It felt as if someone had put a mask over my face, one lined with snow. "Harry said it was his good angel. I think you're him. So where were you?" Now she was the one who sounded unclear because she'd begun crying. "Ma'am, Ellen, you're not making any sense. I took him to the airport after he got his orders and his leave was over. He was going to NAM, and I told him to watch his ass. He said, 'Don't worry, sis. I've got a guardian angel to watch out for me, remember?' So where were you on the 6th of February in 1968, Mr. Angel? Where were you when my brother died at Khe Sanh?
Where were you then, you son of a bitch?"
She said something else, but I don't know what it was. By then she was crying too hard. I hung up the phone. I went into the bathroom. I got into the bathtub, pulled the curtain, and put my head between my knees so I was looking at the rubber mat with the yellow daisies on it. Then I screamed. Once, twice, three times. And here's the worst. I didn't just wish Al had never spoken to me about his goddamned rabbit hole. It went farther than that. I wished him dead. I got a bad feeling when I pulled into his driveway and saw the house was entirely dark. It got worse when I tried the door and found it unlocked. "Al?" Nothing. I found a light switch and flipped it. The main living area had the sterile neatness of rooms that are cleaned regularly, but no longer much used. The walls were covered with framed photographs. Almost all were of people I didn't know. Al's relatives, I assumed. But I recognized the couple in the one hanging over the couch, John and Jacqueline Kennedy. They were at the seashore, probably Hyannisport, and had their arms around each other. There was a smell of Glade in the air, not quite masking the sickroom smell coming from deeper in the house. Somewhere very low, the Temptations were singing, "My Girl," "Sunshine on a Cloudy Day," and all of that. "Al, you here?" Where else? Studio 9 in Portland, dancing disco and trying to pick up college girls? I knew better. I'd made a wish, and sometimes wishes are granted. I fumbled for the kitchen switches, found them, and flooded the room with enough fluorescent light to take out an appendix by. On the table was a plastic medicine caddy, the kind that holds a week's worth of pills. Most of those caddies are small enough to fit into a pocket or purse, but this one was almost as big as an encyclopedia. Next to it was a message scribbled on a piece of Ziggy notepaper.
"If you forget your 8 o'clockies, I'll kill you,
Doris." My girl finished, and just my imagination started. I followed the music into the sick room stench. Al was in bed. He looked relatively peaceful. At the end, a single tear had trickled from the outer corner of each closed eye. The tracks were still wet enough to gleam. The multi-disc CD player was on the night table to his left. There was a note on the table, too, with a pill bottle on top to hold it down. It wouldn't have served as much of a paperweight and even a light draft because it was empty. I looked at the label, Oxycontin, 20 milligrams. I picked up the note.
"Sorry, buddy. Couldn't wait. Too much pain. You have the key to the diner and you know what to do. Don't kid yourself that you can try again either, because too much can happen. Do it right the first time. Maybe you're mad at me for getting you into this. I would be, in your shoes. But don't back down. Please, don't do that. 10 bucks is under the bed. There's another 500 bucks or so inside that I saved back. It's on you, buddy. About 2 hours after Doris finds me in the morning, the landlord will probably padlock the diner, so it has to be tonight. Save him, okay? Save Kennedy and everything changes. Please, Al."
You bastard, I thought. You knew I might have second thoughts, and this is how you took care of them, right? Sure, I'd had second thoughts. But thoughts are not choices. If he'd had the idea I might back out, he was wrong. Stop Oswald, sure. But Oswald was strictly secondary at that point, part of a misty future. A funny way to put it when you're thinking about 1963, but completely accurate. It was the Dunning family that was on my mind. Arthur, also known as Tugga. I could still save him. Harry, too.
"Kennedy might have changed his mind," Al had said.
He'd been speaking of Vietnam. Even if Kennedy didn't change his mind and pull out, would Harry be in the exact same place at the exact same time on February 6th, 1968? I didn't think so. "Okay," I said. "Okay." I bent over Al and kissed his cheek. I could taste the faint saltiness of that last tear. "Sleep well, buddy." Back at my place, I inventoried the contents of my Lord Buxton briefcase and Fancy Dan ostrich wallet. I had Al's exhaustive notes on Oswald's movements after he mustered out of the Marines on September 11th, 1959. My ID was still all present and accounted for. My cash situation was better than I'd expected with the extra money Al had saved back, added to what I already had. My net worth was still over $5,000. There was hamburger in the meat drawer of my refrigerator. I cooked up some of it and put it in Elmore's dish. I stroked him as he ate. "If I don't come back, go next door to the Ritters," I said. "They'll take care of you." Elmore took no notice of this, of course, but I knew he'd do it if I wasn't there to feed him. Cats are survivors. I picked up the briefcase, went to the door, and fought off a brief but strong urge to run into my bedroom and hide under the covers. Would my cat and my house even be here when I came back, if I succeeded in what I was setting out to do? And if they were, would they still belong to me? No way of telling. Want to know something funny? Even people capable of living in the past don't really know what the future holds. "Hey, Ozzy," I said softly. "I'm coming for you, you fuck." I closed the door and went out. The diner was weird without Al, because it felt as if Al was still there. His ghost, I mean. The faces on his town wall of celebrity seemed to stare down at me, asking what I was doing here, telling me I didn't belong here. exhorting me to leave well enough alone before I snapped the universe's mainspring. There was something particularly unsettling about the picture of Al and Mike Michaud, hanging where the photo of Harry and me belonged. I went into the pantry and began to take small, shuffling steps forward.
"Pretend you're trying to find the top of a staircase with the lights out," Al had said. "Close your eyes, buddy. It's easier that way."
I did. Two steps down, I heard that pressure-equalizing pop deep in my ears. Warmth hit my skin. Sunlight shone through my closed eyelids. I heard the shat-hoosh, shat-hoosh of the weaving flats. It was September 9th, 1958, 2 minutes before noon. Tugga Dunning was alive again, and Mrs. Dunning's arm had not yet been broken. Not far from here, at Titus Chevron, a nifty red Ford Sunliner convertible was waiting for me. But first, there was the former yellow card man to deal with. This time, he was going to get the dollar he requested because I'd neglected to put a 50-cent piece in my pocket. I ducked under the chain and paused long enough to put a dollar bill in my right front pants pocket. That's where it stayed, because when I came around the corner of the drying shed, I found the yellow card man sprawled on the concrete, with his eyes open and a pool of blood spreading around his head. His throat was slashed from ear to ear. In one hand was the jagged shard of green wine bottle he had used to do the job. In the other he held his card, the one that supposedly had something to do with it being double money day at the green front. A card that had once been yellow, then orange, was now dead black. Chapter 10. I crossed the employee parking lot for the third time, not quite running. I once more rapped on the trunk of the white over red Plymouth Fury as I went by. For good luck, I guess. In the weeks, months, and years to come, I was going to need all the good luck I could get. This time I didn't visit the Kennebec Fruit, and I had no intention of shopping for clothes or a car. Tomorrow or the next day would do for that, but today might be a bad day to be a stranger in the falls. Very shortly, someone was going to find a dead body in the mill yard, and a stranger might be questioned. George Amberson's ID wouldn't stand up to that, especially when his driver's license was for a house on Bluebird Lane that hadn't been built yet. I made it to the mill worker's bus stop outside the parking lot just as the bus with Lewiston Express in its destination window came snoring along. I got on and handed over the dollar bill I'd meant to give to the yellow card man. The driver clicked a handful of silver out of the chrome changemaker he wore on his belt. I dropped 15 cents into the fare box and made my way down the swaying aisle to a seat near the back, behind two pimply sailors, probably from the Brunswick Naval Air Station, who were talking about the girls they hoped to see at a strip joint called the Holly. Their conversation was punctuated by an exchange of hefty shoulder punches and a great deal of snorkeling laughter. I watched Route 196 unroll almost without seeing it. I kept thinking about the dead man and the card, which was now dead black. I'd wanted to put distance between myself and that troubling corpse as quickly as possible, but I had paused long enough to touch the card. It wasn't cardboard, as I had first assumed. Not plastic, either. Celluloid, maybe. Except it hadn't exactly felt like that, either. What it felt like was dead skin. The kind you might pare off a callus. There had been no writing on it, at least none that I could see. Al had assumed the yellow card man was just a wet brain who'd been driven crazy by an unlucky combination of booze and proximity to the rabbit hole. I hadn't questioned that until the card turned orange. Now, I more than questioned it. I flat out didn't believe it. What was he, anyway? Dead, that's what he is, and that's all he is, so let it go. You've got a lot to do. When we passed the Lisbon drive-in, I yanked the stop cord. The driver pulled over at the next white-painted telephone pole. Have a nice day, I told him as he pulled the lever that flopped the doors open.
Ain't nothing nice about this run, except a cold beer at quitting time, he said, and lit a cigarette.
A few seconds later, I was standing on the gravel shoulder of the highway, with my briefcase dangling from my left hand, watching the bus lumber off toward Lewiston, trailing a cloud of exhaust. On the back was an ad card showing a housewife who held a gleaming pot in one hand and an SOS magic scouring pad in the other. Her huge blue eyes and toothy red lipsticked grin suggested a woman who might be only minutes away from a catastrophic mental breakdown. The sky was cloudless. Crickets sang in the high grass. Somewhere a cow lowed. With the diesel stink of the bus whisked away by a light breeze, the air smelled sweet and fresh and new. I started trudging the quarter mile or so to the Tamarack Motor Court. Just a short walk, but before I got to my destination, two people pulled over and asked me if I wanted a ride. I thanked them and said I was fine. And I was. By the time I reached the Tamarack, I was whistling. September of 58, United States of America. Yellow card man or no yellow card man, it was good to be back. I spent the rest of that day in my room going over Al's Oswald notes for the umpteenth time, this time paying special attention to the two pages at the end marked Conclusions on How to Proceed. Trying to watch the TV, which essentially got just one channel, was an exercise in absurdity. So when dusk came, I ambled down to the drive-in and paid a special walk-in price of 30 cents. There were folding chairs set up in front of the snack bar. I bought a bag of popcorn plus a tasty cinnamon-flavored soft drink called Pepsol and watched The Long Hot Summer with several other walk-ins, mostly elderly people who knew each other and chatted companionably. The air had turned chilly by the time vertigo started, and I had no jacket. I walked back to the motor court and slept soundly. The next morning, I took the bus back to Lisbon Falls. No cabs. I considered myself on a budget, at least for the time being, and made the Jolly White Elephant my first stop. It was early and still cool, so the beatnik was inside, sitting on a ratty couch and reading Argosy.
"Hi, neighbor," he said.
"Hi yourself. I guess you sell suitcases?"
"Oh, I got a few in stock. No more than 200-300. Walk all the way to the back."
"And look on the right?" I said.
"That's right. Have you been here before?"
"We've all been here before," I said. "This thing is bigger than pro football." He laughed.
"Groovy, Jackson. Go, pick yourself a winner."
I picked the same leather valise. Then I went across the street and bought the Sunliner again. This time I bargained harder and got it for 300. When the dickering was done, Bill Titus sent me over to his daughter.
"You don't sound like you're from around here," she said.
"Wisconsin originally, but I've been in Maine for quite a while. Business."
"Guess you weren't around the falls yesterday, huh?"
When I said I hadn't been, she popped her gum and said, "You missed some excitement. They found an old boozer dead outside the drying shed over at the mill." She lowered her voice.
"Suicide. Cut his own throat with a piece of glass. Can you imagine?"
"That's awful," I said, tucking the Sunliner's bill of sale into my wallet. I bounced the car keys on my palm.
"Local guy?" "Nope. And no ID. He probably came down from the county in a boxcar. That's what my dad says. For the apple picking over in Castle Rock, maybe. Mr. Cady, he's the clerk at the Green Front, told my dad the guy came in yesterday morning and tried to buy a pint, but he was drunk and smelly, so Mr. Cady kicked him out. Then he must have went over to the mill yard to drink up whatever he had left, and when it was gone, he broke the bottle and cut his throat with one of the pieces."
She repeated,
"Can you imagine?"
I skipped the haircut, and I skipped the bank, too. But I once more bought clothes at Mason's Menswear.
"You must like that shade of blue," the clerk commented, and held up the shirt on top of my pile.
Same color as the one you're wearing. In fact, it was the shirt